Thank you very much for this nice introduction. It's a real pleasure for me to be here and to have an opportunity to discuss some interest in physics. I would start by thanking my collaborators with whom this work was done. Many of them are present and former Stony Brook and Brookhaven postdocs and graduate students. And here is a brief outline. I will start from the beginning, remind you what chiral symmetry is, what parity invariance is, and then we'll talk how these things play together with magnetic field in dense quark gluon matter and in some of the modern quantum chiral materials. So first of all, what is chiral symmetry? We all have intuitive understanding of the concept of chirality, but I really like the definition given by Lord Kelvin, who said, I call any geometrical figure chiral if its image in a plane mirror cannot be brought to coincide with itself. So of course the hand is a classic example of a chiral object which gave the name to this term. But of course there are many others. The usual screws come left-handed and right-handed, spin half fermions come left-handed and right-handed. And other objects like nails and spin zero bosons are obviously not, do not possess chirality. Perhaps the first person who discovered the notion of chirality in microscopic world was Louis Pasteur, who, among many other great things he did, observed the rotation of light polarization in tartaric acid, which is absent in the synthetic one, but present in the naturally occurring one derived from wine lees. And this he attributed to the asymmetry between left and right crystals in this acid. So in case you don't know what wine lees are, this is the sediment at the bottom of wine casks. So next time, you know, you empty a couple of glasses of wine and observe the light rotating in your eyes, you will know what the microscopic origin of this phenomenon is. So now parity invariance. So this is also a very intuitive thing. In odd number of dimensions, parity is just a reversal of coordinate. And this is the place where people usually laugh and say, well, isn't it a reversal of the radius vector in any number of dimensions? And the answer is no. Let's say if you have a system with even number of dimensions, then the parity transformation corresponds to inversion of just one component of the radius vector, and you can easily convince yourself by drawing something on a piece of paper and putting a mirror next to it. So rotation, inversion of coordinate in two dimensions would be rotation and not the parity transformation. So all objects we are dealing with in physics can be divided into parity even and parity odd. So here are some examples of parity even and parity odd objects. And in particular, the electric current and electric field are parity odd objects. And magnetic field and angular momentum are parity even objects. And that's why, for example, in Maxwell's theory, a static magnetic field cannot be a source of electric current because it would violate the parity conservation. But we will see that these phenomena indeed are possible. So in classical electrodynamics, as I said, parity is conserved. This Maxwell theory is even under P and CP. So you can just look individually at all these equations and convince yourself that they conserve parity and charge parity times parity, so-called CP invariance. But we know that P and CP are violated by weak interactions. as discovered in this classic experiments on the weak beta decays. And there is a significant amount of CP violation encoded in the mass matrix of the standard model, in the phases of the mass matrix. So the obvious question is, what about strong interactions? Can strong interactions violate parity and CP? In principle, it is possible, but for some reason, which we do not understand, this is one of the open problems of the millennium, to understand why this is the case. For some reason, strong interactions do not violate P and CP, and the tightest constraints, experimental constraints, come from the measurements of electric dipole moments, for example, electric dipole moment of the neutron. So as I said, the so-called strong CP problem of why this is the case is still an open one. But today, I would like to address a somewhat different question, whether large local P and CP odd fluctuations can appear in strongly interacting matter. So now, how do we go about discussing this parity odd states of matter? A good start is to follow advice from Maxwell and go to mathematics in search for the most harmonious and the most beautiful. And the appropriate piece of mathematics has to tell us that we have to think of gauge theory as of an interesting geometrical construction where you have space-time and a local gauge transformation which depends on the point in space-time generates a line or a fiber at any piece at any point in space-time. And the set of these fibers or a bundle of these fibers is really what is gauge theory, including Maxwell electrodynamics, from the point of view of geometry. So now this fiber, this bundle of these fibers, in general possesses non-trivial topology. It can have all kinds of knots and twists, as illustrated here by the Möbius strip. And we have to find a way to classify the corresponding topology of this gauge field. So the appropriate piece of mathematics here was developed by Chern and Simons in 1974. And the most relevant part of this paper is for us today is this chapter 6, where they classify topology in three dimensions in terms of some Riemannian connection and the curvature tensor. And for those of us who are physicists, of course, we wonder what it really means in terms of gauge theory. So luckily, it's quite easy to translate from the language of geometry to the language of physics. And this connection which appears here is just a gauge field, and the curvature tensor is just the field strength tensor. So this formula from Chern and Simons in the language of physics defines the following object in terms of the gauge potential in the field strength tensor. Part of it is abelian, and part is non-abelian. It involves the commutator. And in fact, the first term in this expression was known to people doing magnetohydrodynamics since the 19th century under the name of magnetic helicity. So what this thing counts, what this integral counts, is the number of times the lines of magnetic field wrap around themselves. And when you integrate it over entire space, this is a quantized quantity. It's just an integer. So if you look at it, at this expression from the point of view of a physicist, you realize that this could be an action for some three-dimensional gauge theory, which is gauge invariant up to a boundary term. Now, the fact that you can take this knot, so this is so-called trefoil knot, and you can distort it, you can stretch it any way you like, but the number of knots in this system is the same, means that this action is topological, which means it does not depend on the metric of space-time. So you can, there is no place for Einstein's G-menu here. It knows only about the topology of space-time. What's interesting about this is that because of this anti-symmetric tensor, so this is A dot B, which we have here, this is a parity odd object. And in terms of knots, you can understand it because there are left-handed knots and right-handed knots. And so it's kind of clear intuitively that this has to be something which breaks parity. So there is an interesting piece of history here as well. So here we go back to Lord Kelvin, whom I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, who around 1870 suggested a theory that all atoms are really knots in the ether. And the variety of atoms actually is explained by the variety of knotted configurations you can make out of ether. And so this theory, of course, eventually was ruled out, but as we will see today, it actually is reincarnated in modern gauge theory. So this was a wrong physical theory. However, starting with Lord's collaborator Tate, it gave birth to the development of knot theory. And so we owe to Kelvin much of what we know today about knots and the corresponding gauge theories. So now we have seen that there is indeed a possibility of having these knots in gauge theory. And in fact, there are explicit solutions of Maxwell equations in empty space. So they are so-called Young-Mills equations. The only difference from Maxwell equation is that there is these are the gluon fields. And now I write this Maxwell or Young-Mills equation in empty space. And it appears that it has non-trivial solutions even in empty space. So the reason these solutions exist is because there is a coupling between rotations in usual space-time, the indices mu nu, and rotations in color space A. And so instead of going into the math, let me just give you an intuitive explanation of what's going on here. So suppose we have, let's say, a quark with spin parallel to its momentum, so it's a right-handed quark. Now, in general, if this quark moves in empty space, its chirality, its projection of spin onto momentum would be a conserved quantity. It's just angular momentum conservation, basically. However, if it moves in the background of this solution, which mixes rotations in usual space with rotations in the space of color, none of the usual spin and the spin associated with rotations in the space of color are conserved. Only the total spin is conserved. So as a result, what can easily happen is that the spin of the quark can flip. And this would not contradict to momentum conservation because this flip of the spin and chirality would be compensated by a rotation in the space of color. So this is actually quite spectacular phenomenon. Let's say if I had a spinning top on this table and I started to rotate it in one direction, then this would correspond to the situation where the spinning top all of a sudden would reverse the direction of its rotation. And this, of course, would be impossible for an isolated spinning top. But if I had a different one hidden under the table, which would compensate for this flip of rotation, then this would become feasible. And this is exactly what happens in the background of these solutions. So these things actually are seen in first principle numerical simulations of quantum chromodynamics when you discretize it in space and time, and you look at the vacuum structure. And this is how the vacuum of quantum chromodynamics, the theory of strong interactions, looks like. So you have these bubbles of positive and negative chirality, positive and negative topological charge, which keep coming in and out of existence at any moment and in every point of space. And this is what's going on in this room right now as I speak inside each of us. And these fluctuations are actually responsible for 95% of our physical mass because these are the interactions which give masses to protons, neutrons, and so on. So the technical thing is that this is how these things look if you remove sort of short wavelength fluctuations. And if you don't do this, then the picture is somewhat different. You have these fractal surfaces of topological charge in the vacuum, and it's not understood to this day what is the underlying physics. But basically, we come to the following picture. The vacuum, of course, does not possess net chirality. It's parity symmetric between right and left. However, if you just poke your finger in the vacuum at any given point, you are likely to find either a right configuration or a left configuration. And so this is this histogram, which measures the probability of finding left or right. It is, of course, symmetric, which means the parity is not violated. But at any given point in the physical vacuum, you run into either left or right-handed gauge field configuration. So now we have these sectors in the vacuum which correspond to different numbers of nodes of this gauge field. And there are, since we are not in three dimensions, but in we also have time, we can have transitions between these sectors. So for example, in magnetohydrodynamics, you could think of these transitions as transitions when the number of knots of this magnetic flux changes by one, either increases or decreases. And so this vacuum transitions, which I showed you before, they are so-called the instanton transitions, which describe the tunneling. If you are at finite temperature or at finite energy, then you can also have processes which are thermal activation processes, when the system can change this winding number by, you know, a unit. And so there is really a random walk in the space of this number of nodes. So these things are also seen in numerical experiments. So this one actually describes this thermal activation process in electroweak theory. So there is this incoming wave, the energy density grows, and then at the peak value, there is a topological transition, which in electroweak theory actually corresponds to the violation of baryon number. It's not chirality as in QCD, it's the violation of baryon number. The way I presented this to you, we sort of classified this topology in terms of classical field theory. And so you may wonder what's going to happen to all of this at strong coupling, because we know that as the coupling grows strong, the quantum corrections to classical configurations sort of completely dilute them. And you may wonder what's going to happen to this picture at strong coupling. But it appears that the rate of this topology changing transitions actually is still strong at strong coupling. As the coupling goes to infinity, it's a very large number. So nothing bad happens to this topology changing transitions in strong coupling. So the way these computations are done at strong coupling, this is done for supersymmetric conformal theory. And these computations rely on so-called holography, correspondence between field theory in Minkowski space-time, and the anti-de-Sitter five-dimensional space, which is really the interior of this Minkowski boundary. So this construction actually is reminiscent of an ancient metaphor of the cave described by Socrates in Plato's Republic. And let me remind you what this is. So there is a cave. There are prisoners who are chained to the wall of the cave. And all these poor people can see is only the shadows of real events, and they can hear only the echoes of real sounds. And in this setting, the prisoners would take the shadows to be real things and the echoes to be real sounds, not just reflections of reality, since they are all they had ever seen or heard. So in this construction where we are chained to the Minkowski boundary of the higher dimensional space, this is actually quite similar to the construction of Socrates. The only difference is that at finite temperature, in this construction, you have a lantern which sheds the light. And at finite temperature, in this case, instead of a lantern, you have a black hole which shines Hawking radiation. Otherwise, the two constructions are really similar to each other. So now, this you can also compute this Chern-Simons diffusion rate in real QCD using real-time lattice simulations. So this was done by a number of people, including ourselves. And we've seen this strong fluctuations of Chern-Simons number in real time, so we know that it does happen in real quantum chromodynamics. So now the question that I would like to ask myself is, well, we have some theoretical arguments that this topology is important and that it plays a role. How can we tell in experiment whether or not this topology is important? And in particular, this hot matter can be produced in heavy ion collisions. And how can we probe for this kind of phenomena in heavy ion collisions? So this was actually my starting point towards this chiral magnetic effect and so on. So then I will try to argue that, in fact, this topology change in transitions induce electric dipole moment, which signals PNCP violation. But because there is no global PNCP violation in QCD, event by event, the sign of this electric dipole moment will fluctuate, but there are large dynamical fluctuations of this quantity. So the first thing which we will need to observe is that heavy ions, of course, are positively charged particles which move almost with the velocity of light. So let's say this ion is surrounded by Weizsäcker-Williams magnetic field which rotates this way. This ion is surrounded by a magnetic field which rotates this way. So at the intersection point, these magnetic fields add up. And you can compute this magnetic field by plugging these sources into Maxwell equations and just do the usual classical calculation. So if you do it, then this is what you find. You find magnetic field, which is quite strong early on, in which rapidly drops as a function of time. So later it was pointed out that if the medium is conducting, then in fact this fall off is not quite as fast, because in the conducting plasma, the falling magnetic field induces by Lenz's rule the circular currents, and they in turn create magnetic field which resists the fall off. But anyway, at early moments, for sure, you create quite strong magnetic field. Well, how strong it is really? If you express it in units in which normal people measure magnetic field, which is Gauss, not MeV squared, then you find that these fields in heavy ion collisions are about 10 to the 17th Gauss. And this is indeed an enormous field. It is much stronger than anything which can be created in a laboratory. And it's even two or three orders of magnitude stronger than the strongest field which exists in the present-day universe, which is the surface field of the magnetar. So this is really enormous field. And at this field strength, the electromagnetic interactions are no longer tiny corrections to strong interactions, because EB is now on the order of strong interaction scale. Electromagnetic interactions with this field are as strong interactions themselves. So they are order one effects. So now the question is, what happens to these topology changing transitions in such strong magnetic fields? Maybe magnetic field kills these transitions. Well, at least in this conformal field theory, which I mentioned before, this is not the case. Just last month, we computed these rates of topology changing transitions as a function of magnetic field. And you see that in strong magnetic field, this rate actually gets enhanced. So instead of going like temperature to the fourth, in strong magnetic field, it goes like magnetic field times temperature squared. And this is can be understood as a consequence of dimensional reduction, because in very strong magnetic field, particles are magnetically confined. They cannot move in transverse direction. They can only move along the direction of magnetic field. So you get this factor of T squared, which is like 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory, and the factor of B, which is the density of these states in the transverse plane. So from the point of view of holography, this corresponds to this BTZ black hole background. So nothing bad happens to this Chern-Simons diffusion rate in strong magnetic field. So now comes an interesting point, because you have, if you have this background magnetic field, then you have a very interesting phenomenon of non-conservation of electric current. So formally, this is a consequence of so-called quantum anomaly. So you have non-trivial quantum correlations between two vector currents and one axial current or chiral current. And in this particular case, one external vector current is provided by magnetic field. The axial current is provided by chirality imbalance parameterized by the chiral chemical potential. And as a result, you get a source for the vector current. So if you compute the divergence of the vector current in this background, which has magnetic field and which has some chirality imbalance, you find a non-zero answer. So the coefficient here is completely fixed, and one can prove that there should be no weak coupling corrections to this formula. Later on, we will see that this formula actually remains exact even when the coupling becomes arbitrarily large. But before I go into further discussion of this formula, let me point out some interesting features of this result. So as I said before, electric current is parity odd quantity, and magnetic field is parity even quantity. So this conductivity here has to be parity odd, and this means that we are dealing with the parity odd phenomenon. Which is not surprising, of course, because this mu parameterizes the difference of the chemical potential between left-handed and right-handed objects. So it is indeed a parity odd object. Now, if you look at properties of it under time reversal, it's even more interesting, because electric current is odd under time reversal. Magnetic field is also odd under time reversal. And so you conclude that this transport coefficient has to be even under time reversal. This is a highly unusual property for a conductivity. For example, if you compare this with the usual ohmic conductivity, which is defined by this formula here, then this is T odd quantity, this is T even quantity. So ohmic conductivity is T odd, and it's T odd because it describes dissipation, production of entropy, and dissipative process. Unlike the ohmic conductivity, the conductivity which is even under time reversal cannot describe processes which are accompanied by the production of entropy, because every time you can produce entropy, you produce an error of time, and you cannot reverse it. The second law of thermodynamics forbids you doing this. So this describes a non-dissipative current, and that's why there is so much interest in related phenomena among people who are doing, let's say, quantum computing and related things. So there is another simple way to understand what's going on using a well-known so-called Maxwell-Chern-Simons theory. And the way you the way you can understand how this theory emerges is you have quarks which have both color charge and electric charge. And since they have color charge, they interact with this topologically non-trivial knotted configurations of gluon fields. And since they have electric charge, they interact with photon fields. So they induce effective coupling between chirality induced by these fluctuations of gluon fields and the magnetic helicity. So C is the coefficient which you get by evaluating this diagram explicitly. And these are the equations of motion. So they look almost like Maxwell equations, except for these two terms. And let us just see what these terms can do. So first of all, let us consider the situation where we have some kind of topological domain, and there is a magnetic field which goes through it. So let's assume that this field theta, which describes deviations from trivial topology, is not equal to zero inside and is equal to zero outside. This means that there is a gradient of theta, and the gradient of theta, as you can see from this Maxwell equation, acts exactly like the electric charge density. So the product of this gradient times magnetic field is the electric charge density. So then what you get is that since the sign of this gradient is opposite on opposite domain walls, you induce negative electric charge here and positive electric charge here. So the configuration acquires electric dipole moment, which signals violation of P and CP invariances. So this is, of course, somewhat schematic, but you can construct an explicit illustration of this, taking this instanton solution, which I described before, put it in external magnetic field. And in the case of a strong external magnetic field, you can solve this problem exactly, which was also done by us quite recently with Gyokchi Basher and Gerald Dunn. And you can indeed find that the instanton in magnetic field acquires electric dipole moment. And there is a very simple way to understand it. So electric dipole moment can be written down in this way, where this is sigma 3 is projection of the spin along the direction of magnetic field. And these are right and left-handed modes of quarks. So magnetic field pins down the direction of sigma 3, and the instanton creates asymmetry between left and right modes, as we discussed before. So in the presence of instanton, this difference no longer vanishes, and you indeed acquire electric dipole moment. To see that the current emerges, you can use another Maxwell equation and consider the case where theta is homogeneous but time-dependent. And here you can see explicitly that this transport coefficient is even under time reversal because theta is a T-odd field, and when you differentiate it with respect to time, you get a T-even quantity. So now, so this was the answer which was obtained in terms of field theory, but several people, starting from Hong Yi, who is now a postdoc at Stony Brook, computed this current using this strong coupling methods, holography. And somewhat surprising result of this was that the magnitude of this current at strong coupling was exactly the same as at weak coupling. So we knew already that there would be no perturbative corrections to this coefficient, but what he showed is that there are no corrections even when you go beyond perturbation theory, even at infinitely strong coupling. So this result was confirmed by a number of people later on, but it suggests a very interesting direction for research. Because if this current persists at strong coupling, then we know that at strong coupling, the adequate description of dynamics at finite temperature is based on hydrodynamics. And so then there has to be a way to see how such phenomena appear in hydrodynamical formulation. So I will come back to this. But first, let me show you some first principle numerical simulations which indicate that this effect indeed exists. So first I will show you a movie from ITEP group. And they show the surfaces of positive and negative charge on the lattice as a function of magnetic field. So first magnetic field is equal to zero. The lattice is completely black, so there is no charge separation. Then the magnetic field starts to increase, and you can see these surfaces of negative and positive charge appearing on the lattice, and so it's clear that the local separation of charge begins to occur. This was also seen by the Columbia Brookhaven Riken lattice collaboration with state-of-the-art light domain wall fermions. So again, you see that around topological solutions, positive and negative electric charge separate in magnetic field. And this is indeed a phenomenon which is linear in the strength of magnetic field. However, you may say this is not yet a direct test of this formula for the current that I wrote. And usually, lattice cannot really deal with phenomena which happen at finite chemical potential. This has to do with some technical sign problem. However, in the case of this chiral chemical potential, it was pointed out some time ago that this technical difficulty does not arise, and you can actually perform first principle simulations at a finite value of mu 5 directly. And this is what was done quite recently. And in this case, you can see explicitly how the current moving along direction of magnetic field emerges as a function of the chiral chemical potential and as a function of the magnetic field strength, and it has the expected linear dependence on both. So it's a first principle numerical proof of the existence of this effect. So now let me go back to hydrodynamics. At LHC, we now hunt for the ultimate theory of everything at high energies, but we also shouldn't forget that we already have a theory of everything at low energies, and this theory of everything is hydrodynamics. And the reason it is so general, because it's based on a very simple principle. Hydrodynamics simply states that the response of the fluid to slowly varying perturbations is completely determined by conservation laws, conservation of energy, momentum, charge. Then all you have to do is supplement conservation laws with so-called constitutive relations, and you have your hydrodynamics. So speaking of applications of hydrodynamics to hadronic strongly interacting matter, it has a convoluted history. Early applications were due to Fermi, Landau, and Hagedorn. And at least Landau was motivated by the fact that all field theories which were known at that time had the property of screening. So what it means is that if you get closer and closer to the charge, the interaction gets stronger and stronger. And so the idea was that if you create a super dense matter where the average distance between constituents is very small, then this super dense matter will be strongly interacting. And so then it would be described by hydrodynamics, because this is the theory of strongly interacting matter. Then, of course, asymptotic freedom was discovered, which is anti-screening. And so people came to the concept of quasi-ideal plasma, and so the applicability of hydrodynamics was questioned. And this approach was abandoned with the notable exception of Bjorkin himself, who kept working on it. And what happened at RIC is we learned that in spite of the fact that asymptotic freedom, of course, exists and is undeniable, in the regime which we can reach in experiment, the coupling is still very strong. And so this plasma is deconfined, but is strongly coupled, and it is very accurately described by hydrodynamics, and is accurately described by this holographic methods that I mentioned before. So I will not go into details of how hydrodynamics applies to heavy ion collisions, just take my word that it's extremely successful in explaining the angular distributions, the azimuthal anisotropies observed in heavy ion collisions, dependence on momentum, on the energy. It just works. So now let me talk about hydrodynamics as an effective low-energy theory. So you can view it, indeed, as an effective low-energy theory, which is built on the expansion in the ratio of the thermal length to some typical variation scale L. And each term in this derivative expansion, it's derivative because 1 over L is derivative, is multiplied by an appropriate transport coefficient. So one of these transport coefficients is shear viscosity, there is also bulk viscosity, and so on and so forth. So all of these transport coefficients, in fact, are related to some properties of this gravity in extra dimensions. For example, shear viscosity, which is defined through the correlation function of the energy momentum tensor. We know that the energy momentum tensor excites graviton in gravity, so it has to do, this correlation function of energy momentum tensor is really related to propagation of graviton in this background. Likewise for bulk viscosity and for this topological transitions, which I was describing before. It all fits nicely into this strong coupling holographic description. And now I would like to ask the central question of my talk, which is how this anomalous currents, like the chiral magnetic currents, appear in hydrodynamics. So, as I said, hydrodynamics really is based on conservation laws. Now, conservation laws are a consequence of symmetries of the underlying theory. So let's say we have quantum chromodynamics. These conservation laws are the consequences of the symmetries of this theory. So now we know that some of these symmetries can be broken by quantum effects, just like the part of the chiral symmetry, flavor singlet part of the chiral symmetry. So then the question is, what happens to hydrodynamics when some of the symmetries of the theory are broken by quantum effects? This question is not trivial because usually we think of this quantum effects as arising from ultraviolet cutoffs from very short distances. And hydrodynamics is a theory which works at very large distances. So how would the physics at very short scales affect the physics at very large scales? So this is the basic question. So the first step was done by Son and Sorovka not long ago. They wrote down the hydrodynamical equations allowing for these terms. And then they found that the positivity of the entropy production rate, the second law of thermodynamics, actually completely fixes the structure of the currents which are generated by magnetic field and vorticity. And in one of these coefficients, in one of these terms, we recognize the chiral magnetic effect exactly with the coefficient which we evaluated before in field theory. So now, unlike non-relativistic hydrodynamics, first-order relativistic hydrodynamics is a very problematic theory because it's acausal. As a result, it's numerically unstable. So one has to do second-order formulation, and everyone who works on relativistic hydrodynamics actually uses second-order formulation. However, when you try to generalize it to second order, you find a huge number of terms which are caused by these anomalies. And 15 of them are specific to second order, 18 independent transport coefficients appear overall. And there are, this looks sort of boring, but there are very interesting new phenomena which are encoded in this in these terms. For instance, there is a term which describes electric current flowing perpendicular to the applied electric field. There is a term which describes a deformation of the shape of the droplet when you put it in external magnetic fields. There are all kinds of weird and interesting phenomena encoded here. And so it would be nice to really evaluate the corresponding coefficients. So, of course, the first one can try is to use the Sonnen-Sorovkas argument, compute the derivative of the entropy, divergence of the entropy, and say that it has to be positive. So it worked at first order, but at second order, you know, it's not enough, because you have just one constraint, and it's not really very useful. And so the question is whether there is another guiding principle apart from the positivity of entropy production that one may use. And here we can go back to the beginning of the talk and recall that all these currents, which are described by T even transport coefficients, actually are non-dissipative. And non-dissipative currents are not allowed to produce entropy at all. It's not that the entropy production has to be larger or equal to zero. It has to be strictly equal to zero. There is another way to see it, because all these terms are not only T even, but they are also parity odd. And suppose we had a system which was described by this parity odd transport coefficient, and the entropy would grow in our world. Then I could look at this system in the mirror, and because the corresponding coefficient is parity odd, in the mirror world, the entropy would have to go down, and this would contradict to the second law of thermodynamics. And so you can see that the only way out is to assume that production of entropy is strictly equal to zero. Now, this appears to be a surprisingly powerful constraint, and it allows to compute analytically 13 out of 18 transport coefficients, so most of them can be computed analytically. Then, of course, the question is, can we check whether these results are true? And here, luckily for us, some of these relations, which we got by applying this principle, some of these relations can be checked by using the results of fluid gravity correspondence. And in fact, three of these relations, highly non-trivial relations, which we could check, we checked, and they are satisfied exactly by the fluid gravity results. And by now, in fact, all of these coefficients have been computed, and all of these coefficients satisfy exactly this relation. So we have some confidence that this approach really works. Now, there are some very interesting phenomena in this chiral hydrodynamics, and I would like to illustrate just one because of the lack of time, which is so-called chiral magnetic wave. So the physics here is quite simple, in fact. So you have this chiral magnetic effect, and you have its relative a chiral separation effect, which is the flow of axial current induced by the vector chemical potential. So suppose you have a system with zero mu A and zero mu V, so a neutral and chirally neutral system. Suppose I always have fluctuations in any dynamic of system. So suppose I have fluctuation of the vector density. So fluctuation in vector density is going to give me fluctuation in axial current. Fluctuation in axial current will give me fluctuation in axial density. Fluctuation of axial density will give me fluctuation of vector current. Fluctuation of vector current will give me back the fluctuation of vector density. So now you can see that you have, in fact, two waves of chiral and electric densities which are coupled and which propagate together as gapless excitation in the system along the direction of magnetic field. So this is a new type of excitation in relativistic plasma in magnetic field. So this is sort of, it looks like a sound like excitation. However, if you evaluate the velocity of this excitation, then you find that in strong magnetic field, the velocity of this sound like excitation goes to velocity of light. So this is a sound like mode which propagates with the velocity of light along the direction of magnetic field, and it should exist in any system of relativistic fermions. So now let me say a few words about experiments. So there are ways to hunt for these asymmetries in experimental data at RIC and LHC. So there are observables which are sensitive to the strength of fluctuations. Maybe I will not go into detail here. The bottom line is that if you do not have any such fluctuations, then you would expect to see no difference for same charge and opposite charge hadrons. So you would expect to see something like either zero, or it can be shifted from zero, but there should be no difference between same charge and opposite charge. Now, in experiment, you see that there is a huge statistically significant difference between same charge and opposite charge correlations, signaling dynamical fluctuations of this electric dipole moment. So statistical significance of this effect is about 8-9 sigma. So this has been seen by two collaborations independently at RIC. So there was quite a bit of excitement about this. I hope I convinced you that no law of nature was broken to generate these things, and they are quite natural. There is ongoing debate on whether or not this can be explained by combination of conventional physics. So this is not quite, this discussion is ongoing. An important check was to see that this effect disappears when the plasma is no longer produced at low collision energies, and this is indeed the case. This is a recent result from RIC. And if you go to high energies, since magnetic flux actually is invariant of energy, because electric field, magnetic field grows linearly with energy, and the transverse size shrinks as 1 over energy, magnetic flux is invariant. And so as a result, the effect was expected to be invariant as well. And this is indeed the case at the Large Hadron Collider, where the effect is also present. So there is another test of this physics, which does not rely only on electric charge. And this has to do with the correlations between the electric charge asymmetry and the baryon number asymmetry. So this is the work we did with Son. And the ratios between electric charge and baryon asymmetries are completely fixed by the structure of this theory. And so now experimentalists are verifying this. So we will know the results quite soon. This is a completely model-independent prediction. So now a few words about the broader implications of this physics. First of all, we know that there are parity-odd phenomena in our universe at very large scales. So the universe is filled with magnetic helicities, and magnetic helicities, as we already know, is a parity-odd object. In fact, if you evaluate the corresponding energy density, which corresponds to this magnetic field, then the energy density in this magnetic field is about the same as the energy density in the cosmic microwave background. So parity violation is sort of order one effect in the universe. And so there is an interesting question about whether the cosmic microwave background itself can be polarized. And people were wondering for a very long time about the origin of these magnetic fields in the universe. And I think Fermi was the first to suggest that they had to originate in the Big Bang. And so this coupling of chromomagnetic and magnetic fields, especially if axions exist, provide an interesting mechanism for generating magnetic helicity at the QCD phase transition. So now, coming to the origin of matter, antimatter symmetry, we all know the famous three Sakharov criteria, one of which is CP violation. And so what this discussion in heavy ion physics points to is that the CP violation in the Big Bang may not be a true global CP violation in the Lagrangian, but it could be just a dynamical fluctuation in some quantity. And so let's say if you repeat the Big Bang, maybe the sign of baryon asymmetry would be different, and you could have some kind of gravitational instanton in the Big Bang, which would induce effects very similar to the ones we are discussing in heavy ion physics. And finally, there are a number of interesting applications for this chiral physics in some condensed matter systems. Systems like graphene, topological insulators, wild metals. And in fact, graphene, for example, appears to be quite similar to this strongly coupled quark-gluon plasma in several ways. First of all, it's a very strongly coupled system, and this may be surprising because it's electromagnetic interaction. However, the effective coupling constant in graphene is E squared over H bar times Fermi velocity, not the velocity of light. And since Fermi velocity is 300 times smaller than velocity of light, the corresponding alpha is 3 times larger than alpha in the vacuum, which is about 2, and which is exactly on the same range as the effective coupling in quark-gluon plasma. So all this discussion of perfect liquid behavior, viscosity, and so on can be repeated here, and this was done. And in fact, the shear viscosity in graphene in fact, gets quite close to this quantum bound. So then there are ways to create a chirally imbalanced graphene by putting it on substrates. We did a lot of work on magnetized graphene, putting it on a magnetic substrate, which is magnetized in plane, and you can induce a number of interesting phenomena. For example, the emergence of analog of chiral condensate in QCD, which is excitonic condensate in this system. There is a very interesting ongoing work on this topologically protected edge states and the currents in topological insulators, which have a lot of similarity to the physics that I discussed today. So there are some really interesting connections here. But it's time for me to summarize. And my summary will be very simple. There are some interesting phenomena which emerge due to the interplay of topology and magnetic fields, including the chiral magnetic effect. And these anomaly-induced phenomena, in fact, are an integral part of relativistic hydrodynamics. So in the next edition of a textbook on relativistic hydrodynamics, these things have to be included, because without them, relativistic hydrodynamics is simply not a consistent theory. So let me thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer your questions.